Well, let me start with this. When I was a kid, there was a period of time when my family played a game. I'm not sure if you could call it a game. I'm going to leave it up to you how fun you think this game was. It was called the Manners Game. And it was meant to teach me and my two sisters, I'm the oldest of three girls, my two younger sisters are Mindy and Lindsay, obviously to be polite. And so what would happen is one of us would hand out 5 pennies or nickels usually to each one of us, including my parents, and we'd have to place those coins in a row in front of our plates where everybody could see them. And then we would pay attention to one another throughout dinner. And whenever somebody did something impolite, then we would point that out and we would get to take one of their coins. And the person with the most coins at the end probably didn't have to load the dishwasher or something, right? Can you imagine how that went? If you've got kids especially, maybe you're like, oh, that might be some doozy fights. That's what I remember. I remember it getting super nitpicky because Mindy and I are only 16 months apart, and so it was definitely a competitive relationship, and it would be like, okay, you give me a penny because your napkin wasn't on your lap before you touched your fork, or, you know, reach over to get the salt, it's between us, and then you're like, no, you reached across me. No, I didn't, it's between us, but no, it's right here, you know, and so whenever I think of the Manners Game, I'm like, oh, no. My youngest sister, Lindsay, says she remembers a smug sense of superiority every time she would win, but she also remembers removing herself from the table in frustration several times and going and sitting in another room. So I called my mom, because my mom's an online congregant, just so you know. Hi, Mom. I told her I was going to do this, right? So I called her up and I was like, Mom, the Manners Game, do you stand by it? Yes, I absolutely do. 100%, we would do it again. So that one's for my mom. I think to give her some credit, I was like, as an adult, I can understand this a little bit more. I remember playing it on vacation a lot, right? So you've been at the beach all day with 3 young kids who are squirrely, go out to eat, and you're like, I just need something to make sure they're not totally melting down in public. Maybe it's a little bit of that. So that's for you, Mom. I love you. I bring up the Manners Game as an example of something that was designed to ramp up rivalry, right? For the greater good. I learned manners. But part of the Sermon on the Mount that we're talking about today is the opposite, right? It's how to reduce rivalry. It's how to take that down. And so we're going to look at 3 spiritual practices that Jesus talks about from Matthew chapter 6. He goes through generosity, prayer, and fasting. But this bit is, I think, actually less about the practices, which were taken for granted as being helpful for shaping people's character, right? So it was less about the practices and more about how we do them. So it's heart issue stuff here. So there are 3. We are going to look more closely at the prayer section next week because the Lord's Prayer is part of that, right? The Our Creator in Heaven. So we'll really hone in on that, but today I'm going to read around the Lord's Prayer, and we'll hit those surrounding bits. So let's read those together. It's a little bit of a longer passage if you want to look at your notes. Matthew 6, starting in verse 1. Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets, to be honored by others. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. And then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. And then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. And when you pray, do not keep on babbling like the pagans, for they think they'll be heard because of their many words. Don't be like them. Your Father knows what you need before you ask him. And when you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others that they're fasting. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face so that it will not be obvious to others that you're fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. All right, so we can see where all 3 of these have a similar structure to them. All right, they start out with don't be hypocrites. followed by, don't go around doing spiritual practices in a way that says, hey, look at me, look how spiritual I am. And then that's followed by, what matters is what God thinks of us. All right, so Jesus is using the word hypocrite here in all three of these scenarios, but I think he's not using it in quite the same way that we would normally use that word. Right, when we think of a hypocrite, we usually think of somebody who is saying one thing and doing the opposite. Right, so like you're in the front seat and you're wadding up your McDonald's trash bag and you're saying, don't litter, kids, as you toss it out the window. Right, that's what we would think of as a hypocrite. But when Jesus is calling people hypocrites, he's calling out the motives. Right, so these were people who were doing the things that they were expected to do, but they're doing them to be seen as good people to gain community standing, right? They weren't doing the practices to shape their hearts or with a motive, you know, for actually caring about what's happening there. They're doing them for social approval. Got that there, Maurice. Get that, there you go. All right. So if you guys have been around church very long, you know that I've done quite a lot of work on something that's called scapegoat theory. I've been using some insights from the Stanford scholar, Rene Girard. If you haven't been around, don't worry. I'm not going to go too much into that this morning. But there's a part of that theory that I think is helpful for us as we discuss this part of the sermon. And it's the part that talks about how we are mimetic creatures. Right? And mimetic just means we imitate each other. Right? Think of the word mime. Right? Mimetic. And that we do this for survival. Right? Like my friends just adopted a baby, and she's at that point where if you stand in front of her and you smile really big, she starts to smile back, right? That's part of like the baby's process of imitating the adults, and the neural pathways are building. So she's learning to smile by watching us smile and learning to coo, and eventually we'll learn to walk, right? It's this thing that we do almost from the moment that we're born as we watch each other and we listen to each other's voices and imitate. So even as adults, we often imitate the body language of the people that we're engaging with, especially if that engagement is friendly, if we want to be affiliated with the person, like if we're wanting to be their friend. Sometimes there's been some, do this off notes, I remember reading a study once about business deals, and that they were quantifying, like they could tell how often a business deal was going to go through by how like mimetic the other person's body language was in the room, by how like sort of friendly they were toward that deal, right? But even if we're not mimicking another person's body language, our brains often are. So if my wife Rachel there, if she lifts her right arm and I'm watching her, my brain is sending signals for my right arm to lift as well. Now, luckily, we've got all of these overriding mechanisms that keep us from just like going around copying each other's movements all day long, right? So you're not gonna sit there and dance in this very cool way that I dance. Right? But even if these overriding mechanisms keep our bodies from involuntarily moving around, our brains are still acting like what they see. But not only do humans imitate each other physically, we also imitate each other's internal states. Right? So sometimes when I'm talking to somebody who I can tell is really, really anxious, I try my best to keep my internal state as calm as I can. I'm a little anxious too, so sometimes that's a struggle. But I try to do that so that it's not increasing my anxiety, and in fact, I'm hopefully helping to decrease theirs as they're imitating me, right? It's sort of a pastoral care thing to try to be a non-anxious presence. You know, chaplains and therapists are generally pretty good at this. So Jesus hadn't read Rene Girard, but I do think he intuited this imitation aspect of human nature a bit. And I think he's addressing it here. Like, he knows that we can be easily swayed by the people around us, right? That we are really super susceptible to being swayed by crowds and by the groups that are communities that we're in. So I think Pastor Daniel gave a really great sermon last week. I recommend you listen to it if you didn't. And he was talking about how humans imitate each other's violence, right? Jesus is like, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Right? That's describing imitation, right? Hostile imitation. And then how Jesus interrupts, like gave advice on how to interrupt that imitative cycle of violence. And Jesus recommends things like nonviolent resistance techniques. He recommends praying for our enemies. And these are things that are meant to like disrupt that imitation of the other's actions. So he was talking about how to interrupt people hostile to us, but I think he's also concerned about something else. Right, I'm going to go backwards just a little bit to the end of Matthew 5. He said, if you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? If you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Don't even the pagans do that? So I think Jesus wants to free us not just from imitating our enemies, but also from uncritically imitating our in-groups. See that? Also from uncritically imitating our in-groups. So Father James Allison, who's a Catholic scholar, he writes this. He says, whether it's a matter of love or hate, reciprocity is the same in both cases. You're run by the social other, and you become a function of that social other. So if you love those who love you, you become more and more dependent on their approval, which means that you also allow your behavior to be shaped by their expectation, and then you find yourself automatically tied into sharing their shared attitudes about contempt for those who they despise. But Jesus said, there's nothing especially good about that. Is that making sense a little bit? In other words, he's saying, like, when there's a baby born in a mafia family, the other families in the mafia, they make spaghetti casseroles for each other too, right? They're kind to their in-group. I'm not picking on the mafia, like, I like spaghetti too, but it's just that you can get your love and your belonging, your affirmation from a group whose values maybe don't always reflect God's values, or maybe some of their values, or maybe many or most do reflect God, but not all of them. And can we discern between those two if we're chiefly concerned with keeping other people's approval, right? With keeping the in-group happy. And that it's really hard to see through the weeds when it's your own people and when there's belonging at stake and when conforming is the easiest way to protect that belonging. But it's not always the best for giving us room for growth and for discernment and for change. And so I think Jesus' concern here is that sometimes for the sake of following his teachings, for the sake of justice, we have to be willing to risk losing some community approval. And it's hard to risk that when we care more about the community approval than we do about God's approval. So I read Jesus as helping us dial down our imitation of and our need for approval from our in-groups here. Right, so when he's telling us to be more private about praying and giving and such, it's less about making a rule that's saying you should do something like this, like you should only pray in private. There was a lot of communal praying in Judaism in his day. I don't think he's trying to make this rule. I think it's more about helping us to be careful that we have space to care most about how God feels about something. Right, that Jesus wants to orient us to imitate God's heart. And I know I'm preaching to a choir a little bit here. I know many of you have risked community approval for like a more inclusive faith, but even so, we're not insulated from this dynamic, right? We're not excluded from that, we're human. So let's look at this part about generosity. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets to be honored by others. Let me just be clear, nobody did this. There's no record of people going around like blowing trumpets when they gave away money, right? But ram's horns, or shofars, were blown on Friday evenings before the Shabbat service, right? So this was something that his audience kind of knew what this was like, and he's kind of winking at them, I think. It might be like me looking at you and kind of, don't go around ringing a Salvation Army bell every time you hand out $5 to somebody on the street, right? So it's kind of a figure of speech. I don't think Jesus is saying you can never tell anyone when you give away money. Like, I was trying to think of a kind of a ridiculous example that would probably not apply to any of us here. But like, I think it could be fine to have your name put on a medical college if you gave a ton of money to that medical college or something when you're donating. But I think Jesus would say, ask yourself why you want to do that. Right? Be careful, he says. Be curious about your motives. Be curious about what's driving that desire. And maybe that desire is you're like, well, gosh, you know, my grandma was the first person to graduate from a medical school. That's not true. This is completely made up. But maybe you're like, that was true. And I want people to like, I want to honor her and see that people broke barriers for this to happen. I want them to be inspired. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But be careful, Jesus says. Have insight into your own heart. Is it something you're telling yourself? But actually, maybe you are a little bit concerned with gaining access to the Board of Regents. Maybe you're a little bit concerned with having your phone calls picked up by important people. And so you have to ask yourself, is that access and the power, is that maybe the real driver? And if that's true, be cautious. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. You might find yourself strategizing your giving to maximize your power. And if you do that, you might be more inclined to care about what your influential circle thinks about you and less inclined to speak out in the face of injustice. Right? So this is about protecting our hearts, and I think it's twofold. I think he's saying, look, your life will not be better if you start to play these rivalrous games with other people to see who can be seen as more important. And two, you need to be sure that you can be true to God's values if those values are tested. And so if you can do that, go for it. If not, give in secret so that you learn the freedom of caring only about God's approval. Does that make sense? I also think it can be helpful when community leaders talk about their giving, if it's not done in a way that says, look at me, I'm amazing. I think it needs to be something like, I believe in this too, and I put my money where my mouth is. Right? The Apostle Paul, in his leadership role, he oversaw several churches. He would say things like, imitate me as I'm imitating Christ. So I think leaders are held to a little higher account when they talk about giving away money. We're talking community leaders, any sort of leader. Right? Because you're trying to help people learn to imitate Christ. So the prayer part, I'm going to just breeze through this. We'll do a little bit more on it next week, but I just want to give it a little bit of context. Jesus is talking about praying in public, but in Jesus' day, people prayed what was called fixed hour prayer. So people would stop what they do at various times of the day, wherever they were, and they would pray. And this was usually in conjunction with the Roman bells that would be rung. So, right, Jesus lived under the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, there'd be bells rung in public that would announce different times of day. So 6 a.m., 9 a.m., noon for lunch, 3 o'clock, 6, right? Usually about every 3 hours. And so people would just use that to stop where they were, say a prayer, much like how Muslims pray 5 times a day. Many Christians also use fixed hour prayer and have through the years, especially in the Catholic and Orthodox traditions. Our Episcopal friends, Ken Wilson in the back, taught me how to do it. If you are at all interested in experimenting with fixed hour prayer, this is a little aside. Sue Dykstra, who's over there, you can raise your hand if you want. She and I are going to invite people to give it a try during Advent up through Epiphany. So there's a little book called Christmastide. And if you would like to learn how to pray the hours, we are going to meet this week to figure out a time to do that. And we'll do it. We'll offer it online and probably do an in-person as well. So I'll just put that out there if you'd like to get the book. But all to say, that was normal for people to pray publicly. Jesus prayed publicly. I don't think he was against it. But he was warning about the temptation to strategically place yourself in places that draw attention to your piousness, right? So it's like if you're out and about, but maybe you just happen to be in front of the mayor's house when that noontime bell hits. Oh, look at that. Oh, maybe I'll just stop and pray right here. Or maybe you happen to be in front of Sharon Moore's house, the U of M coach. And you're like, what a coincidence. Let me get down on my knees and pray loudly so everybody can maybe notice how amazing I am. And so Jesus is essentially saying, if you find yourself strategizing so that you're like in the right place at the right time to magnify your spiritual standing, be careful. And then the same is true with fasting. He says, don't go looking around unkept so people know how pious you are. Right, and often in that time, it was done communally, right? It was usually associated with a holy day like Yom Kippur. I don't usually talk a lot about fasting from the pulpit because a lot of people struggle with eating disorders in our culture. And so I think that attaching like a sacredness component to that can sometimes like turbocharge eating disorders. I've seen that happen, and so I try not to do it. But I do think it might be just worth saying a little bit about it. And growing up in the church, I often associated fasting with like showing how serious I was about something to God, right? I don't know if some of you experienced that, but it was like, I'm praying for something and it's really earnest and important to me, so I'm going to show God how serious I am about it, so make sure that they'll turn their face toward me. But that's not usually how it's used in the Bible, right? It usually had a couple of different purposes. For one, it can help us identify with the hungry and move our hearts in compassion. So that's one reason to fast. It can also help a community focus its attention in response to something they think that God is doing, and to help them discern what that is. Right? So it's more responsive and less proactive. It's not like, okay, I need to earn my prayer points, and more about like, okay, I feel like God's doing something and I want to be able to like remove some noise from my brain and really focus on figuring out what that is. Right? So it's not a bad practice, but I would just say if you have even a whiff of, oh good, that could help me with my weight or something like that, just don't do it. It's not a good practice for you. Stay away from it. And again, I don't think it's bad to tell people that you're fasting. I think a lot of people will do that like during Lent, when it's pretty normal for Christians to fast, and you say, I'm going to fast from social media. It's pretty obvious, right, if you disappear for 6 weeks online. Sometimes people fast from chocolate or meat or whatnot. I think it's just inviting us to ask ourselves why we're announcing it. Right? Is it to show everybody how spiritual we are? And if it is, just don't do it. But if it's to invite people to come along on this journey with you in responding to God, I actually think that's fine. Right? So I think Jesus is just saying, be careful, be curious. Because key things to following Jesus are just practicing humility and doing our best to imitate God's heart and not the values of our in-group. And so Jesus, I think, is just trying to free us from this competition with others and from being beholden to groupthink. And the way that we can be shaped by the heart of God is through things like prayer and generosity. All right. With that, I'm going to lead us into a time of meditation. That was a little bit of a longer one. We usually spend a minute or two in just silence or guided meditation. People make noise. It may not be completely silent, but I thought I would just invite you to use this space where if the Spirit was kind of talking to something, saying something to you through this, that you could maybe have a little conversation with God about it. Or maybe you're coming in here with like a completely different concern this morning that's on your heart. And so we'll just use this silence as a time to commune with God about it. I'll let you know when the time is up. So Jesus, I ask that you would just help shape our hearts with the desires of God, that you would help us to tune out noise of our in-groups, that you would help us to be freed from rivalries that we feel with others in our community, and that we can really just be focused on reflecting your values in the world so that we can be a blessing to those around us as well as to the creation. In your name we pray, amen.